Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We get going this week inspired by an article in Forbes that says Kentucky is now on the radar of the high-tech industry and that it can mean a good job if you have an advanced degree. So for many, the question is, how do I get one of those? Well, we're told that starts with challenging students at a young age and exposing them to advanced courses, and that's a problem in many Kentucky school districts. Bridget Blom's latest guest in our series on education and Kentucky's economy is Dr. Jonathan Plucker, professor of talent development at Johns Hopkins University and the author of The Excellence Gap in Education.
Dr. Plucker, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, Bridget. Happy to be here.
Jonathan, you coined the phrase excellence gap. What does that mean, and what does your research tell us about closing this gap?
Excellence gaps is a term we came up with. Gosh, it feels like yesterday, and it feels like 100 years ago at the same time. About 2008, 2010, we just noticed that lots of educators, policymakers, community members were talking about gaps in education, but they were mostly talking about sort of grade level mastery gaps. And my colleagues and I were talking about the fact, you know, in terms of economic development, you know, having a vibrant culture, national security, yes, we should be closing all achievement gaps, but excellence gaps, sort of gaps between different groups of students at the most advanced levels, was actually probably a bigger problem that this country really needs to solve. We're not seeing much national federal movement in this direction, but several states have really begun to focus on, for example, why so few lower income students, rural students, are performing at advanced levels compared to their urban suburban peers, to their higher income, upper middle class peers. The research tells us it's mostly about opportunity, Bridget. It's just that students in small towns, rural areas, we've done national surveys on this. They just have fewer advanced opportunities than students living in bigger communities do, wealthier communities do. And yet we've also done studies showing there are very talented students in every town, in every school within the Commonwealth. You have talented students. The difference is some of them have opportunities to do advanced work and some don't. And the ones who don't, not surprisingly, are not really getting those opportunities to then thrive. And that's what we're trying to tackle here. And that's what this bill does, I think, fairly successfully.
Representative Duval of Bowling Green has introduced a bill in the legislative session that would increase access to advanced coursework and would create an automatic enrollment for students who meet proficiency levels, meet benchmarks in particular areas, mathematics, maybe English language arts, in sciences, and they would then automatically be enrolled in an advanced coursework. And so you're seeing strategies like that take hold in other states where they're also wrestling with the idea that you've described, that our students are ready for more. We need to ensure that more is there for them as they pursue their personal and innate potential.
Yeah, I think North Carolina is probably the best example for Kentuckians to look at. They started their automatic enrollment specifically in mathematics in 2019. They've tinkered with it a little bit. We have been studying how they're implementing it, what the effects are. We don't have student achievement outcomes yet, but we know that about 10% of North Carolina students who were ready for advanced coursework were never being given those opportunities. After the passage of this law, that number has dropped down to pretty close to 0%. And so I think Texas is seeing similar results. Their law is about a year and a half old. And there's four other states that have varying degrees of implementation. But there is no question that it's a big opportunity driver. It tends to be very politically popular. These laws tend to pass fairly easily. In part, we think, because many policymakers just assume that if you're performing at high levels, you're automatically placed into advanced classes. That's true for most students. It's not true for all of our students. Again, especially those who haven't been getting those opportunities, they are actually hiding in plain sight, right? Like they are performing really well. There's just no advanced opportunities for them to take. This proposed law would require school districts to have those opportunities. And again, fairly small sample size, 6 states, it does appear to work. And it actually appears to work very, very quickly, which I think makes it a very, very promising policy initiative.
Jonathan, there are two things I'd like to tease out of our conversation. And one is the importance of students learning at higher levels and what that means for industry, for economic development, for their career pathways. And the other is the idea of automatic enrollment and why automatically enrolling students in the next rigorous class is so important. So let's take the first one, which is the importance of higher levels of learning for the future economy and the workforce.
We as Americans, we have an economy and culture which has a tremendous thirst for talent that you can never satisfy. This country thrives when we have talented people contributing, right? Yet our schools, and this is true in every single state, struggle to provide advanced opportunities. It just has not been a traditional focus of American schooling. That is changing. We're seeing it with automatic enrollment laws, accelerated learning laws, et cetera. That's a really important long-term change that will benefit all of us for decades and decades to come. But you have to have those opportunities. And I think it's not just helping students do, you know, advanced learning, advanced skill sets. But if you're challenging someone, helping them go from, say, average achievement or even below average achievement to advanced achievement, we know that's possible. We know what to do to help students get there. That also creates a mindset that being intellectually challenged, that being intellectually curious is a good thing. And we know that those are psychological attributes that also lead to additional innovation, creativity, economic development. So there really is no economic downside, which is why I think, frankly, you see many of our global economic competitors investing heavily in advanced education. China, European countries, Russia, et cetera.
It's important for the space science field. Naturally, people go to engineering, math and science field, but it's also important for our healthcare fields.
Every single field benefits from advanced achievement. The humanities benefit from advanced achievement. Medicine absolutely benefits. Engineering, there is literally no economic downside to putting a stronger emphasis on advanced learning.
So why the need for automatic enrollment?
It just seems that for some reason, some school districts either don't think they have advanced students or do and just don't think that they can make sort of the economics work to offer advanced courses. 20 years ago, I would have absolutely agreed that these are complicated issues. But we've done so many studies now, Bridget, where we've shown, yes, you do have these students. Every school district in Kentucky has students who are capable of highly advanced achievement learning accomplishments. So that we can check off. You absolutely have those students there. But then we also know that we have a lot of options like high-quality virtual education now, online courses, summer programs, weekend programs. There are lots of different ways to provide challenging advanced learning, advanced services to students, many of which don't have to cost anything extra from what you're currently spending. Essentially, it is the same number of students still. Right. And so it's just that you're realizing that some of them have much greater capabilities than you may have been giving them credit for, which is just human nature. Right. And so it's all about opportunities and then using things like advanced technology to help provide these opportunities at a very efficient cost, I think, is really important.
So increasing access, a lot of times we'll hear, you know, with the teacher shortage, and especially in a state like Kentucky that is so deeply rural, it's really difficult to find teachers who can teach these advanced courses. And it's difficult for our schools to bring teachers into the community that have a background in, say, physics or higher levels of mathematics, a variety. So you've mentioned a couple of maybe non-traditional ways to deliver the content. Are you seeing states adopt those non-traditional ways? And what are some of the most promising examples you're seeing?
We are seeing states like North Carolina get very creative about how they can find, for example, teachers to teach advanced math. But I do think that virtual online coursework, or like hybrid sorts of courses where you can have students in different buildings all taking the same class from the same instructor at the same time, I think those are very, very promising. One thing that we need to keep in mind, I'm a Gen X person. The idea of taking courses online horrified me. Like, why would you ever do that? Until I saw my daughter take an entire year of high school advanced math online. And I went to her and was like, oh my gosh, that must have been horrible. And she was like, horrible? It was awesome. And I realized, oh, they're digital natives. They are used to learning in all sorts of different modes that my friends and I never even experienced. And students are starting to really respond well. And of course, we're getting really good at online education. We get better every single year. Artificial intelligence is certainly helping with that. So it is very possible now for students to fill in those gaps when there are teacher shortages or there aren't enough students for a certain class. There are ways to do this. I also think that schools need to be open to things like, if you have a student who is ready for college level coursework and there's no way that you can provide it virtually, in person, et cetera, what does the local community college, what does the local college university offer? What sort of articulation agreements can you, you know, put in place there where like the student can leave the high school campus to go and take a college course because they're ready for that accelerated learning? I think if we're creative and flexible about this, it's actually not a hard problem to solve.
So I imagine, Jonathan, that what you're sharing is music to so many parents' ears as they desire for their young people to not only meet the standards in education, but to excel and realize excellence as they make a life for themselves. What is the role of the community in ensuring that access to advanced coursework is present in a local school district and that a state approaches this?
I do think it is smart to think of this as a broader community issue, to be frank, because if you have a student who is really bright and never getting those opportunities, providing those opportunities, helping that student move to those advanced levels benefits everyone, benefits the student, peers, teachers, the school, the family, communities. There's a very positive value add here. And I think a key piece of it is, though, is that policymakers need to be communicating very transparently about what advanced achievement looks like within each community, within each set of schools. And I believe this bill proposes to do some interesting things there, making sure that the public knows where Kentucky is from district to school district and how to actually promote it so that the community is very well informed.
Jonathan Plucker, Professor of Talent Development at Johns Hopkins University, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation, and thank you for your work.
Thank you, Bridget.
We'll be back in a bit with Kentucky novelist Wesley Brown. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. They All Fall the Same is the title of the latest novel from Wes Brown. Wes has practiced law as a criminal defense attorney, prosecutor, and public defender out of an office in Richmond over the past 24 years or so. And he also owns Apollo Pizza, where he hosts the Pages and Pints reading series. And he's here with us. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Wes.
Thanks, Tom.
So if you would just give us a little teaser, what is your novel, They All Fall the Same, about?
It's about an organized crime boss out of Jackson County, Kentucky, who gets into ultimately a dispute with a similarly situated character out of Madison County, Kentucky. It's been equated to The Sopranos meets the Hatfields and McCoys.
So is this kind of a sequel of your debut novel, Hillbilly Hustle?
It's not, but there's a character from that book that it's about. Uh-huh. So I very intentionally didn't write a sequel, but people will find similarities and some threads through. You know, it's hard to think of a comparison. The best I've come up with is if you watch Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs and then you watch Pulp Fiction, there'll be some couple of threads that go back and forth. It's kind of that sort of a thing. But you don't need to have read Hillbilly Hustle to read They All Fall the Same.
Okay. As I mentioned in the introduction, you've seen the law from all sides. You've been a criminal defense attorney, you've been a public defender, and a prosecutor. How did all that experience inform your work as a novelist?
Certainly in creating characters and situations. No character is exactly someone I've met, and no situation is exactly something I've come upon, but they're all inspired by multitudes of people and multitudes of scenarios I've run across in the courtroom and just kind of out in the world as an attorney. And as you can tell, Burl Spoon's not a law-abiding guy. He's not, in some ways, objectively entirely good. There's a lot negative about him. And so when you write someone like that, it helps to have come from a perspective of having to build empathy for people who aren't necessarily straight arrows and who have a lot of faults. When you're doing criminal defense, you've got some people who've done some bad things, but maybe there's some good in them. Your job is to bring out that good, especially if there's not a defense to it and it's just mitigation. And in terms of how I write, I try to write him in a way that you're realistic about who he is and what he's doing, but you also can care about him. And people say I pulled for him in spite of myself. You know, that they know he's not necessarily a savory character, but they still pulled for him.
I was reading some reviews of the book, and one reviewer pointed that out, that you clearly feel it's important to humanize an otherwise violent, mean character.
Yeah. He was the antagonist in Hillbilly Hustle. He had a bit part as the antagonist. In this book, the antagonist is a guy named Clovis Begley, who I also humanized to a point. I don't think pure villains are very interesting. I think that you want to have a lot of layers to people and understand why they are the way they are. And I thought it was an interesting and fun challenge to make Burl Spoon a protagonist, to get people to sympathize with someone who is capable of bad things. And, you know, Sopranos comes out as a comp a lot, but things like Peaky Blinders and Breaking Bad, people gravitate to those characters. There's something that people love about getting in the driver's seat with those folks and riding along. Well, maybe the passenger seat with them, but anyway, going along with them.
The character's Burl Spoon. He's a cannabis kingpin.
He is.
And as you mentioned, you've got him located in Jackson County.
Correct.
And then Clovis Begley runs a heroin operation out of another county, I assume.
Madison. And I've talked about a little bit about the idea that their two operations somewhat tell you the difference in their characters. Burl doesn't think cannabis is harmful, but it does cause, you know, it's a criminal act and there's violence and that all goes with any criminal act. Everywhere, even in legalized states, you still have some violence around that trade. People would be surprised sometimes at how much there still is. But Burl Spoon's not seeking to hurt anyone and he doesn't want to. He might if he has to. Clovis Begley, who's a heroin dealer, doesn't care. He's in it for his own purposes, and that somewhat sets up who they are in this scenario. They do both care about their families, though, and that's one of the common threads between them.
Okay. There is a lot of violence and even some cruelty in the story. It's kind of, as you said, a modern-day Hatfield and McCoy feud, if not a war. Mm-hmm. How did you get yourself into the mindset to describe that kind of violence and cruelty?
I think it kind of flows back to being in the business. You see a lot of shocking things as an attorney, and your capacity to be shocked, unfortunately, sort of diminishes, and you're just matter of fact about it. And it doesn't mean it doesn't touch you in a deep way. And that's why I write about it, because when you write those things, you know how it's going to affect people reading them. And it's been interesting because some people just don't want any of that in their reading. But if you're going to tell one of these stories realistically, you really have to go there. And so I do. And it's a pretty amazing cross-section of people taking interest in that. I mean, true crime podcasts are all the rage. And a lot of those stories are rough. And so for whatever reason, people are interested in those stories. And if you sugarcoat it, it doesn't work. I try to be genuine in everything I write. And it's not necessarily true. But again, I want it to be genuine. And I that's what I went for in They All Fall the Same.
There's a character in the novel who owns Porthos Pizza, which is set in Richmond, and kind of reminds me of the old Apollo Pizza, which you now own.
I'm one of the co-owners of Apollo Pizza. And so Porthos Pizza was something from Hillbilly Hustle, and it was set mostly at Porthos Pizza. Because it was a crime book, it was based in the reality. Apollo Pizza, back before we owned it, they sold pot out of Apollo Pizza. So my first novel's about that fact. It's completely fictionalized. It just uses that as sort of a jumping off point. But I didn't want to call it Apollo Pizza. So I called it Porthos. And I think once or twice in this book, there's these offhand references to Porthos Pizza. You never go there. You never see it. But I just had a little fun with dropping that back in.
Well, speaking of Apollo Pizza, I know you've hosted Pages and Pints Reading there for some years.
Yeah.
And before Apollo, for a couple of years, you hosted the series at the Richmond Area Arts Council, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
What happens at these gatherings? Are you seeing writers becoming encouraged when they're in the company of other writers?
Writers, at least the writers I know, tend to gravitate to other writers, so they enjoy that. We haven't had as many, honestly, since the pandemic. We've had a few, and we've had some special events. We had a thing called Noir at the Bar, which is all crime writers, and I basically had a bunch of my friends who were crime writers come to town, and we did a couple of cities. But we did one of those as a Pages and Pints. I just did a Pages and Pints with Robert Guype. We're looking to kick that back up again, but yeah, readers and writers gravitate to each other a lot. We used to have them be just mostly reading, and then we would end it. And what we found is readers know what they've read and they're going to read it anyway. We might have a little bit of reading, but we'll have two authors have a conversation about the book and the writing process and that sort of thing. And then we open it up to questions more. That's sort of where most literary events are going, because people don't so much want to sit and listen to books, or read books. They do that on their own. They want to talk about it and they want to hear books talked about. So Pages and Pints has slowly kind of adapted into this different format. And that's what Robert and I did. We talked for probably 20, 30 minutes. I think I read for 2 minutes.
Hmm.
And then we opened it up to the audience and they asked questions for 20 minutes.
Well, if we have a writer out there listening to us right now and they're intrigued by this, is there a way that they could be notified when you're going to have another?
Pages and Pints is on Facebook. And then if you follow any of my social media, Wes Brown Author on Facebook, and then I'm on Instagram and Blue Sky and everywhere else too. I promote them on all of my channels, and that's kind of how we put the word out. And, we still print posters, but I'm not sure how many people are driven to events by the posters we hang, but we feel like we have to do it.
And the book, where can the book be found?
If you go to wesbrownauthor.com, I have a page on there that'll take you to all the different places you can buy it. You can buy it from a lot of different local bookstores, and I provide links to a lot of local bookstores too. And then I provide links to the big guys as well and let people make their own choice.
That's novelist Wes Brown. That's Brown with an E, author of Hillbilly Hustle, and now They All Fall the Same. Thanks for coming in, Wes.
Thanks, Tom.
We've heard from the director of the Eastern Kentucky film Hazard, who was forced by weather to postpone a local screening of the movie about battling and overcoming opioid addiction. Eddie Mensur tells us that they now plan to show the movie at the Benham Inn in Benham, Kentucky at 7 p.m. Thursday, March 20th. Coming up after the break, Dolly Parton's Imagination Library and another Woodsongs instrument drive for musicians in the flooded communities of Eastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Dolly Parton started her Imagination Library back in 1995 with the idea of making it as easy as possible to encourage kids to read and to read books. It's a book gifting program that mails free, high-quality books to children from birth to age 5, no matter their family's income and no matter where they are. 30 years have gone by, and millions of books have turned up in mailboxes around the globe, including right here in Kentucky. And J.C. Morgan is State Director of Dolly Parton's Imagination Library of Kentucky. J.C., welcome to Eastern Standard.
Oh, thank you for having me, sir.
So first of all, a little bit of background on this. What motivated Dolly Parton to start the Imagination Library?
Well, Dolly was doing work in Sevierville, Tennessee, where she's from, with the high school. She paid for their marching band uniforms. She has a scholarship fund that she did for the high school kids, a buddy program. If both kids graduated, they got the scholarship. But she asked educators how she could make even more of a difference. And they told her that early literacy skills were the key to that. Getting books in the home is the most important thing you can do to change the outcomes for the child. So Dolly got the idea to start mailing them books. And in the beginning, it was just random books. It was whatever they could find. Little golden books for a number of years were mailed to the kids. But as it's evolved, now we have a Blue Ribbon selection committee that picks out the books. They are age appropriate right down to the birth month of the child. So if you have two children, one's 1 year, 2 months old, and the other one's 4 years, 3 months old, they're going to get very different books because developmentally they're in very different places. But there is one exception, and that is The Little Engine That Could. Everybody gets The Little Engine That Could as their first book. It's Dolly's favorite children's book, and that's what you're going to get. So start them with The Little Engine That Could. They get these developmentally appropriate books all the way up until their fifth birthday. And then they'll get Look Out Kindergarten, Here I Come. And at that point, they should know their shapes, their numbers. They have just the basic early literacy skills, holding the book the right way, turning the pages, all of that, which is going to be so important to them as they start their educational journey.
Do parents get to pick out a title or is it chosen?
So the books are chosen. All the parent has to do is go to imaginationlibrary.com. You'll see a little link up in the upper right-hand corner that says check availability. You put in your zip code, and in Kentucky, everybody can register at that point. So it's basic high-level information, child's name, birth date, address, parent's name, an email address, phone number. I mean, it takes you 2 minutes to register your child. At that point, the registration goes to what we call the local program partner. Every county in Kentucky has a local program partner who approves those registrations. And this is important because Dolly is very generous and she's paying for all the back end stuff, the computer system that runs all of this, the shipping of the books around. But the local program partner pays for the printing and the mailing of the books, those two things. And so it's $2.60 per book every month. In Kentucky, we're very lucky because the General Assembly approved in 2022 funding for half of that. So here in Kentucky, the local program partner has to pay $1.30 per book per month. So when they approve that child, that's what they're agreeing to do, is to pay that $1.30. Fortunately, in Kentucky, because of that 50% match, we haven't had any problem with programs not being able to pay their bills for the most part. And when there were problems, we've been able to fix them to bring in more partners and more people with more resources and get that problem solved because it is a relatively cheap program. I mean, it's much cheaper than, say, a remedial reading teacher's salary and on a per-child basis, you know, you're talking about $60 for a whole 5 years worth of books. It's not something that's really onerous, but it can get expensive. Like in Lexington, you've got 18,000 eligible children. So if all 100% of them were to register, 18 times $1.30, that does run up a price. Louisville's the same way. But across Kentucky, most of those counties are not in this in that situation. They're 1,000 kids, 2,000 kids. Mm-hmm. And so the local program partners can raise that money with golf outings or donations.
I was wondering. Now, when the committee is choosing which books, do they have themes that they go by?
They do. There's themes to the book, and you can see that on our website, what they're trying to do. But the themes go along with the whole early development process. What they're ultimately after is that five-year-old that knows their numbers and shapes and letters and colors. But one of the interesting things about the selection committee is that they read every single book aloud to each other because the language is so important. These books are intended, a 2-, 3-, 4-year-old can't read. So they're intended to be read to the child. So with that in mind, they read them to one another. Most of the books, I'd say about a third of them, are going to stay the same. They're the ones that we recognize. Corduroy, Llama Llama, Red Pajama. Those are going to stay in the mix. But the rest of them, they do select new books every year. So if you do have another child, you have one child, and then you get another child, sign them up too, because the books will be different. And part of it is just the magic of that child getting the book in the mail with their own name on it. I mean, there was a time when you and I were excited about mail. Now it's just bills. But for the kid, it's an exciting thing to get this new favorite book every month.
Yeah, and there's something about holding a book in your hand. I mean, so much of the information that we take in these days is coming to us on our devices, on video, on the screens. And these are actual print books.
Yes, sir.
Do you think that makes a difference in the child's learning experience?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I like to shorthand that and say laps, not apps. That's, you know, a kid gets so much screen time. Statistically, an American child has enough screen time by the time they're 5 to have a college degree. And that's not a good statistic. These books short-circuit that, because now the parent is sitting there reading with the child. They're laughing. They're pointing at pictures, and the child's trying to say llama and coming out yama or, you know, whatever. And it's an experience. And then eventually that child will go on and experience that same thing. When Charlotte dies, they'll cry. When Gandalf hangs on the edge of the bridge, they'll be sad when he falls. I mean, that's what we're trying to do, is build that whole emotion into it, that love, that security, and then they'll go on and read for themselves.
Well, and I heard something else in your response there that I think is really important and maybe a little bit lost these days because of screen time, and that's that just sitting down on a sofa with your child or with your mom or dad together and experiencing something together in such a physical way.
Yes, sir. And one of the things, there was a, the program in Louisville, Jefferson County, they commissioned a survey last year. And these books typically impact other people as well. So it's a sibling that's reading to the child. It's a grandma that's reading to the child. And sometimes they rekindle a lost love of reading just from reading these books to their children.
If a parent of young kids is listening to us right now and they have not heard about this, even though it's been around for quite a while, it may be news to a lot of people, what can they do to sign up for to get a monthly book in the mail?
It is so easy. ImaginationLibrary.com. Like I said, up in the upper right-hand corner, check availability, put in your zip code, and just follow the prompts from there. On your mobile device, it will take you 2 minutes. I do want to also point out, this is something I'm really proud of. The American Printing House, which is in Louisville, also has a Braille program. If you know of a child who has visual disabilities, and this doesn't have to be a 0- to 5-year-old, they accept children who are a little older, and also parents, because the blind or visually impaired parent has to be able to read to their child too. So they're the same books that we give to everybody else. You can't see it, but I'm holding one up right now, and it has a sticker on it with the raised Braille. And the prisoners at the women's prison there in Oldham County, they actually transcribe these books, put the stickers on, and then they mail them out all over the United States, Puerto Rico. That all comes from the American Printing House in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm really proud of that.
Well, you should be. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. That's J.C. Morgan. He's State Director of Dolly Parton's Imagination Library of Kentucky. Thank you so much for coming in, J.C.
Oh, thanks for having me, sir. I really appreciate it.
If you're a musician, you can just imagine the loss felt in eastern Kentucky when those recent floods carried off or destroyed guitars, mandolins, banjos, and other beloved instruments. WoodSongs creator and host Michael Jonathan has imagined that time and again, and as you'll hear, the musicians of eastern Kentucky are about to have an opportunity to replace those lost instruments. Michael, you and the WoodSongs crew have been collecting instruments for musicians who live in natural disaster areas, and they've lost their own. So how many of these drives have you done so far?
We started with the tornado events in western Kentucky. We saw Governor Beshear on TV, and he looked very teary-eyed, and he looked straight at the camera, and he said the lens is not wide enough to take in the amount of this destruction. And when I saw that, I was like, you know, that's a powerful statement. We want to help. And the last folks in line to get help for anything usually is the arts. It's the first to get cut, and it's the last to get helped. So we thought, you know, let's use the WoodSongs media outreach and go to our, I hate the word fans, but the folks that follow our work. And Lord knows they collected over 1,000 instruments that we brought to Mayfield and Dawson Springs. And then the floods hit Appalachia. We did it again. And then Helene hit, and we collected over 1,000 instruments for the folks in Helene and distributed that. And then while that was going on, Kentucky got obliterated by floods in eastern Kentucky. And so there's no way that we could support our neighbors in North Carolina without helping our own folks here in Kentucky. So we're doing the fourth one in Pikeville on April 13th, and hundreds of people will get free banjos, guitars, flutes, fiddles. Schools, students, teachers, everybody will get a free instrument to replace the ones they lost in the floods.
When you're going through a rough patch, there's nothing like if you're a musician sitting down with your instrument and playing for a while. So I imagine the loss of these instruments has to be hitting people pretty hard.
It is. My favorite story was what happened in Dawson Springs. An 82-year-old man stood in line for 2 hours. And when he came to the table, all he wanted was a Martin guitar. He insisted it had to be a Martin guitar. And if anybody knows guitars, that's the Rolls Royce of guitars.
Right.
And what he wanted, he would sing to his wife on his couch for 52 years every night before bed. He'd pull out his Martin guitar and sing her a song. And the tornadoes came and took his home. It took his Martin guitar and it took his wife. And they found her body, you know, a couple hundred feet away from his home. And all he wanted was to sit at her graveside every night with a Martin guitar and sing to her like he did for 52 years. When we went to Knott County after the floods, there was a little 17-year-old girl that helped us unload the truck, and she stood there all afternoon. And when we were almost done, she was all teary-eyed, and I said, was there anything you want? And she goes, well, you don't have what I want. Well, what is it? Well, my grandpa was in a bluegrass band, and I wanted to honor him by learning an upright bass. And our friend Sharon Oler had just driven in from Versailles with her SUV. And in the back of her SUV was a 1934 Wurlitzer upright bass worth $5,000. And we had this little girl close her eyes, and we brought out the bass, and you should have seen the look on her face. And if your listeners go to woodsongs.com/Helene, there's links to the tornado project, and you can see the story of the 82-year-old man, and you can get the link to the flood project in eastern Kentucky and see the photo and newspaper story of the 17-year-old girl and her upright bass.
Now, I take it you're finding people really willing to part with guitars, mandolins, upright basses and so forth.
Instruments are meant to be played. If they're under your bed, if they're on a wall, if they're in a closet, think about putting them in the hands of a musician looking to heal the loss of what they had just been through. And that's what folks are responding to. They are willing to not so much give away the instrument as they are willing to help their neighbor.
Do you require some sort of proof of residency for people who are accepting instruments?
I don't mind trusting folks. And we've not had a single occurrence of someone trying to be dishonest about anything. And when you're talking to these people in person and you're handing them it to them in person, eye to eye, it's very unlikely that they're going to try to, you know, do something untoward. You know, these are sincere, honest folks. Most of them are mountain people that, you know, they didn't expect to lose their home, their cars, the business they worked in, their neighbors, their family members lost in these storms. So, you know, let's be fair.
So this is limited to one instrument per person, right? But are there exceptions to that?
There's exceptions. If a school comes to us, we want to help them. If a music teacher comes to us, we want, and he's got several students that couldn't fit in the car, you know, we're going to help them. A lot of times it's parents. I've got four kids and two of them want a banjo and two of them want a fiddle. Look, in Roanoke, Virginia, they collected nearly 600 instruments for the Woodsongs Helene Project. 100 violins, violas, cellos, guitars, banjos. Willis Music collected several hundred instruments across Kentucky. The Kentucky Theater received hundreds of instruments that people donated. We're going to give all of these away to people, and I trust them. I trust the ones that we're helping.
Well, tell us about the next giveaway, which will be, I think you said, in April?
April 13th. While we were collecting and organizing folks for Helene and getting ready to distribute the instruments at Warren Wilson College outside of Asheville, the storms hit East Kentucky. Pikeville, Hazard, Prestonsburg went underwater. It's a serious situation. Mm-hmm. And we connected with the Appalachian Center for the Arts in Pikeville, who fortunately are fine. Their building is fine. And they're going to be the host site for all the instruments that we don't hand out in Asheville. We're going to bring back to Kentucky and give them for free to the folks in the mountains of East Kentucky.
All right. Well, this is a really, really wonderful thing that you're doing, Michael, and we all appreciate it.
Well, Tom, you are a musician at heart, and I know if anybody appreciates the amount of work and spirit that goes into doing something like this, I know that you do.
Thanks for joining us. A special note, the initial weekly broadcast of Eastern Standard will move to 1 p.m. as of April 3rd. Rebroadcasts will continue at 8 p.m. on Thursdays and 6 p.m. on Sundays. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our newsletter. And you can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.